heard Lance say dropped, and I just, I'm all goosebumps right now. Look at that.
Good news for the soldier charged in the 2010 Coast Guard helicopter crash. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Cordova digs out, but there's more snow on the way.
We're just trying to get through this as best we can before the next big storm comes in.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
An investigating officer has recommended dropping the charges against the sole survivor of a 2010 Coast Guard helicopter crash that killed three airmen from Air Station Sitka. The Associated Press obtained a copy of Captain Andrew Norris's report. Leone was charged with failing to navigate around safety hazards and with negligently causing the deaths of two of the crewmen aboard the helicopter. Norris's recommendation that the charges be dropped was received as good news by Lance Leone's family. But as KCAW's Ed Ronco reports, the case could still proceed to a full court-martial.
In December, the Coast Guard held an Article 32 hearing. It's like a grand jury proceeding in civilian court where evidence is laid out against a defendant. Captain Andrew Norris presided over the hearing. He's called the investigating officer in military parlance. And according to the report obtained by AP and confirmed by John Smith, Leone's private attorney, Norris is recommending the charges be dropped.
I got the text from John, Lance's lawyer.
That's Leone's mother, Heather Rice, who says she and her son were having lunch when they heard about Norris's recommendation.
I heard Lance say dropped, and I just... my shoulders dropped. It was like, wow. I'm all goosebumps right now. Look at that.
Rice describes the news as a black cloud being lifted.
We couldn't believe it. We looked at each other and I said, really? But we still have to go on from this. The Admiral has not made the decision. So this hasn't ended yet. So I keep telling people, keep the gales in your sails. Because this isn't over yet.
Leone himself is represented by private and military attorneys who have advised him not to speak with the media. Smith, his private attorney, declined to comment when contacted Monday afternoon at his home near Washington, D.C. Coast Guard spokeswoman Lieutenant Veronica Colbath says Norris's recommendation is one more piece of information in the grand scheme of the crash investigation. It will be reviewed by Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, who commands the Coast Guard in Alaska. He's referred to in this case as the convening authority.
The convening authority will review the investigating officer's report and recommendations and decide how to proceed with the case.
Ostebo can follow the recommendations by dropping the charges, or he can send the case on to a full court-martial. He can also decide to handle the matter internally. Colbath says Norris's report is, quote, not releasable while proceedings are underway. Besides being given to Ostebo, the report was shared with attorneys in the case, and Colbath says there's no timeline for Ostebo to make his decision.
The story's not over yet. I mean, it's not over.
That's Lieutenant Colonel John Farr, retired from the Army's Judge Advocate General Corps, and now an attorney in private practice in Anchorage. He's not directly involved in the case, but has extensive experience in military law. Farr says the Leone family has every right to be happy with the recommendation from the Article 32 hearing, but should also know that convening authorities, like Ostebo in this case, are notoriously independent-minded.
They should be mindful of that. However, the Article 32 officer is not likely to look at it any different than a military jury would if they actually end up in front of a military jury. So there should be a certain amount of comfort in that fact. But any positive news like this is something that should be welcome.
Farr has said in previous interviews that acquittals in cases such as this are common. It's a thought he reiterated in light of Norris's recommendation. Farr says the way he interpreted Norris's recommendation suggests to him that Norris might have found probable cause to charge Leone, but based on Leone's service record, doesn't think that he should face a full court-martial. Farr believes a jury would feel similarly.
In other words, if it's a good service member that's been diligent and seems deserving because they've served their country and served the military and and had a good career, then judges and juries, military judges and juries, are very reluctant to just completely end that because of a mistake.
Farr says his personal opinion is that the charges have already done career-ending damage. But Leone's mother, Heather Rice, says her son still loves the Coast Guard and wants not only to be cleared of the charges against him, but also to continue his career. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
A Hoonah man has been declared incompetent to stand trial for the murder of two police officers nearly a year and a half ago. Today's ruling means that a long-delayed jury trial, recently scheduled to start January 30th, will not happen anytime soon. KTOO's Matt Miller has more on the case from Juneau.
46-year-old John Moravin Jr. is accused of shooting Hoonah police officers Tony Wallace and Matt Tokuoka in August of 2010. The incident allegedly included Moravin holding officers at bay and refusing to surrender until a day after the shooting. Superior Court Judge David George Monday listened to testimony by a psychologist who tried to interview and evaluate Moravin, but the psychologist found that Moravin was evasive, uncooperative, hostile, controlling, disorganized, and delusional. Dr. David Spurbeck of North Star Behavioral Hospital in Anchorage believed that Moravin understood the court process and the nature of the charges against him, but his unwillingness or inability to communicate effectively make it unlikely that Moravin could help his attorney in his defense. Two other psychologists previously issued split opinions on Marvin's competency. They testified on their findings back in September. District Attorney Dave Brower said, quote, "We have, for lack of a better term, a tiebreaker." Monday's ruling means that this month's jury trial has been postponed indefinitely. Judge George committed Moravin to the Alaska Psychiatric Institute in Anchorage. Yet to be determined is whether his stay there will include competency restoration treatment. Moravin did not say anything during Monday's competency hearing, except twice he exclaimed, "I object," when Spurbeck spoke about Marvin's apparent culpability in the crime. The next hearing is in April. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
National Marine Fisheries Service scientists released the 2011 population estimate for Cook Inlet belugas today. The current number is 284 whales, nearly 20% less than last year's estimate of 340. But although 20% may sound like a dramatic decrease, so little seems to be known about the belugas that it's difficult to know how significant the number may be. Rod Hobbs works in the National Marine Mammal Lab in Seattle. Hobbs designed the aerial survey that takes place in Cook Inlet each year and has been researching the Cook Inlet population of belugas for nearly two decades. He says the numbers are in slow decline.
But it doesn't seem to be a large decline. It seems to be this continued slow decline that we've seen for the last 10 years since the end of the major subsistence harvest period.
It's not known why the belugas do not appear to be recovering. They are no longer hunted, but concerns about depleted food supplies, pollution from sewage and street runoff from Anchorage, oil development, and vessel traffic have all been highlighted as adding stress to the whales. The Cook Inlet beluga were listed as endangered in 2008, and critical habitat has been designated. There is a recovery team working on a plan to try to turn the population numbers around. In the 1980s, there were around 1,300 belugas in Cook Inlet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after abandoning his winter attempt of Denali, Lonnie Dupree recounts a near-death experience on the mountain.
I self-arrested, stopped my fall. I was too scared to cry at that point.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The weather in Cordova is better today, and locals are taking advantage of it. With the Alaska National Guard on hand, residents are working hard to shovel snow from most of the town's public buildings. As KCHU's Tony Gorman reports, the city is also preparing for another big storm.
Alaska National Guardsmen and locals spent the majority of Monday shoveling the roofs of schools, the library, the museum, and other public facilities. Cordova Public Information Officer Alan Marquette says the biggest priority of the day was to take care of those buildings.
Once those are done, then we'll be looking at other structures, both public and private, that are in serious danger of collapse or hazard because of the heavy snow.
One of the city's lower priorities is clearing the Copper River Highway. The road remains open despite experiencing a small avalanche Sunday afternoon. Marquette says locals have been able to adjust to the current road condition.
There's a loop road that goes around it, and people are using that. So that's not a priority to remove that right now because they're trying to get roads to city, roads to houses, roads to secondary roads open and cleared of snow. When we got that heavy wet snow yesterday and the day before, it really clogged things up and started melting, and so we had pools of water around. So we're just trying to get drains cleared and get that drained away.
The nice weather has been a window of opportunity of sorts for Cordova, but according to the forecast for Monday night and Tuesday, that window is going to close again. National Weather Service meteorologist Michael Lawson says the area is currently under a blizzard watch through Tuesday afternoon.
Tonight we've got snow and blowing snow developing towards morning. It's going to be widespread reduced visibilities to a quarter mile or less at times. Just tonight, snow accumulation up to 2 inches. And then the same thing into tomorrow morning with a lot more accumulation during the day. We're thinking 3 to 8 inches at this point.
Lawson says there's a possibility that the snow will mix with the rain Tuesday afternoon. With more bad weather looming, Marquette says he felt a positive vibe from the community throughout the day.
Even though we've had a tremendous group of folks coming in to volunteer to shovel and bringing equipment, also the city's been paying people to shovel. So between all of that, it's making a big difference, and we're just trying to get through this as best we can before the next big storm comes in.
The city is expected to have more meetings to address its snow removal needs. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
The Renda and Healy continue to slog through difficult ice conditions. They were 110 miles south of Nome this afternoon. The vessels made it just 32 miles closer to Nome this weekend. And given the tough conditions, the ships have begun to take breaks at night to allow the crews to rest up for the next day. There is no set arrival date as the vessels move through some of the toughest ice they will encounter. Kathleen Cole from the National Weather Service Ice Desk says the current ice pack is dense and pressurized.
When you're in a solid area of ice or a very compact area of ice and you're pushing it apart, you're pushing it into ice that's also pretty solid. So you're creating force there. And when you go through it, that force is no longer there and the ice turns around and rushes back in the void that you made.
The Renda became lodged in ice several times throughout the weekend. Coast Guard spokeswoman Sarah Francis was aboard a C-130 flying over the vessels late last week. She says a variety of ice-breaking techniques were used with the Healy escort.
So the Healy did figure eights around them, and they would do circles close to the ship on both sides to create what we call relief cuts to break up the ice enough that it had somewhere to move as the Renda continued to move forward.
The vessel should get a bit of a break later tonight as they enter ice that's thinner and less pressurized. In Nome, teams from Sitnasauk and partners were double-checking equipment and going over the last details of emergency plans. Jason Evans, the Sitnasauk board chair, says state regulators and Coast Guard personnel got a close look at the equipment and conditions for the upcoming fuel transfer. John Cotola, the manager of the Marine Vessels Section for the DEC, says crews used the daylight hours today to get oriented with the situation at the port.
Looking at the ice conditions in that area, working at the moorings for how the ship can be moored up to make sure it's solid into the ice, and then the hose routings, the discharge hose, get a feel for, some estimates of what we think we're going to need for light plants.
And in the air, a research team launched an unmanned aerial vehicle to photograph ice conditions near the port. The team from the University of Alaska Fairbanks is helping to gather data to help chart the tanker's final approach. A 180-foot crab tender ran aground in Unalaska this morning. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce was on scene and has this story.
8.5 to 9. But the stern is free.
The Baranof was switching docks to pick up crab pots when it beached itself in an area known locally as Little South America. This spot is visible from the main road, and it didn't take long for a crowd to form, despite blizzard conditions and a travel advisory in effect for the area. Most of the onlookers were other crab fishermen, but one had been a sailor aboard the Baranof back in the 1970s when it was a Coast Guard buoy tender. He was happy to offer up his insights on the situation.
The longer they wait, the fuel tanks are like right down there, and it's starting to bump down there, they'll have fuel.
Fortunately, the vessel, which was carrying 23,000 gallons of fuel, didn't end up staying on the rocks for long. Immediately after the Baranof ran aground, the tug Saratoga tried refloating it, but only succeeded in breaking several tow lines. So then they brought in the much larger 4,000-horsepower tug James Dunlap to give it a try. In less than 30 seconds, the boat was free and clear.
It's like he's towing the tug now.
The Baranof's mate, Jim Ford, says he's hoping this doesn't mean the end of the season for the vessel.
Have the hull inspected, and if the diver and the Coast Guard are satisfied the hull's fine, we're good to go.
Coast Guard Lieutenant Derek Gibson says there doesn't appear to be any structural damage to the vessel, and there was no fuel discharge. But he added that the Coast Guard will be doing an inspection as well as an investigation into why the boat ran aground. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
The company building a mine at the headwaters of the transboundary Taku River expects a new road to be completed by the end of the year. That will allow year-round access to the Tulsiqua Chief Mine. The Taku is the most abundant salmon-producing river in southeast Alaska. But Saturday, Chieftain Metals tried to reassure members of a Juneau task force concerned about the impacts of the project. Rosemary Alexander from member station KTOO has more.
Chieftain Metals Chief Operating Officer Keith Boyle paints an aggressive timeline for the multi-metals mine under construction in British Columbia, and it hinges on a proposed road.
The mine won't go without the road.
Boyle was speaking by teleconference from Toronto, Ontario, headquarters for the Canadian-owned company. He told skeptical task force members the company expects to have a BC government permit for the road by the middle of this year. Chieftain Metals purchased the Tulsiqua Chief Mine and adjoining properties in 2010 after former owner Redfern Resources went bankrupt. Juneau has terrible memories of Redfern, the number of times Redfern barges hit bottom in the Taku River, Redfern's proposal for a hover barge towed by an amphibious vehicle, its years of promises to clean up acid mine drainage from the defunct mine. Chieftain Metals nixed the hover barge idea soon after it acquired the Tulsiqua, and mine cleanup is underway. As KTOO previously reported, a water treatment plant has been installed and is treating mine effluent. When Chieftain took ownership, it acquired Redfern's permits from BC regulatory agencies, except one, for a road through Taku River Tlingit First Nation territory. The company has been negotiating a new route to the mine with the tribe, which has historically opposed any overland route.
This past summer, we jointly hired an engineer. This engineer looked at different options. We, evaluated the different options. And Chieftain has now submitted an application for an amended permit.
The 81-mile road would go from Atlin, B.C. to the mine site, still through some First Nation territory. It's now up to the B.C. government to get First Nations to agree. Months ago, Chieftain Metals said barging equipment, supplies, and concentrate up and down the Taku River is not an option for two reasons. It's a difficult river to travel, and bankers want to know the product is getting to market. Task Force member and commercial fisherman Lynn Peterson.
What were the parameters to make that decision? And secondarily to that, were some of those parameters run timing in terms of the salmon runs?
It had nothing to do with the salmon runs. It had everything to do with sitting in front of the bankers and saying, you know, we want to build a mine. And they looked at us and said, if you think you're going to do it with hover barges, we're not giving you money.
Boyle says the company expects to haul 15 to 20 100-ton barge loads from Juneau up the Taku River to the mine beginning in late May. Chieftain Metals will contract with tug and barge company Wainwright Marine Services out of Prince Rupert, B.C.
Any material, equipment, whatnot, it's got to fit within 15 trips up the river. And then we're contingency planning that if it's anything less than that, we're trying to figure out what it is. But, you know, 15 to 20 trips for the entire summer.
Some of this summer's loads will be road construction equipment. Boyle says construction will start simultaneously from Atlin and the mine site. The Juneau legislative delegation created the Taku River Fact-Finding Task Force in response to concerns about development on both the U.S. and Canadian sides of the river. Alaska has no jurisdiction over the Tulsiquitchief project or barging up the river. After 2 3-hour meetings with state and federal agencies and Chieftain, the 8-member task force seems to have more questions than answers. It will meet again on Friday. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
The first of the two finalists for the Anchorage School District superintendent position made a 3-day visit to the city last week. After his first face-to-face interview with the school board, the candidate hoping to replace retiring Carol Cuomo visited schools, met Anchorage assembly members, and talked to the local press. KSKA's Len Anderson attended the press conference.
The pair of finalists each faced the same Thursday through Saturday schedule. Last week it was Jim Browder, former superintendent of Lee County Schools in Florida. This week it'll be current Kenai Peninsula School District Superintendent Steve Atwater's turn. The school board's proclaimed timetable calls for a decision between the two by month's end, followed by a transition period with the new superintendent officially assuming the position on July 1st. The Lee County School District Browder served is the 40th largest in the nation with approximately 82,000 students. He says his large district experience would prove valuable to Anchorage.
If I'm here, if I'm not here, this system is really good and has done a good job over the last several years of educating children. I believe that what I bring from a larger district is a sense of how to continue that.
Lee County includes the city of Fort Myers. Student demographics show just under 50% are white, around 30% Hispanic, 15% African American, with multiracial, Asian, and Native American making up most of the remainder. Browder says, like Anchorage, dropout and graduation rates were a major Lee County concern.
The dropout rate in Lee County was 7% when I took the job in 2003, and it's 1.3% now. So we work hard at providing opportunities and options for students so that the dropout rate doesn't go up.
The Lee County District has 93 traditional schools and 24 charter school alternatives. There are approximately 10,000 employees, and the annual budget is over $1.4 billion. While current Superintendent Cuomo will deal with next year's Anchorage School District's budget shortfall, future revenue crunches will likely face her replacement. Under the fiscal management portion of his application, Browder says at Lee County, he coordinated $90 million in district-wide reductions since 2008.
You front-load students and classrooms and teachers, and then you look at everything else. Actually, I have a document that shows the things that we cut. We cut probably 400 or 500 jobs and did that successfully through a majority of attrition over a 2-year period.
Two differences between Lee County and the Anchorage school districts involve revenue sources and budget oversight. For Anchorage, 65% of its operating revenues come from the state, with about 30% from local taxes. In Browder's Florida school district, 55 to 60% of the operating funds came from local taxes. Another difference?
In the municipality of Anchorage, the school board adopts a budget, but final approval comes from the Anchorage Assembly. In Lee County, the school board alone determines the district's mill rate and approves the annual budget. The three-day candidate schedules also include two-hour forums on Friday evenings where the public questions each candidate. This week, Steve Atwater of the Kenai District will hold his forum. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Lonnie Dupree has abandoned his attempt of making the first January solo ascent of Denali. The veteran adventurer from Minnesota spent the weekend making his way down to base camp after 18 days on the mountain. In an audio update posted on his website, Dupree says he spent 7 days pinned in a snow cave by high winds at 14,200 feet and decided to abandon the climb after getting a daunting weather forecast Friday.
I got an update on the weather that I had about a 12-hour window of good, of clear, and then it's going to sock in again with a low-pressure system for another week. So that meant I had to make a decision either to try to hunker down there for another week underground, which wasn't very appealing, or try to, and then assuming that after that week, may or may not have any good weather.
Dupree reports winds gusted in excess of 90 miles an hour above 17,000 feet and to around 80 where he was at 14,000 and below. Down climbing Saturday was harrowing. Dupree says he was buffeted by 60 to 80 mile an hour winds and nearly fell to his death on a section of the route known as Squirrel Hill.
One of those gusts did knock me off my feet and I started sliding down this very steep icy slope, which basically ends up into a fall off of one side of the mountain there. And I self-arrested, stopped my fall. I was too scared to cry at that point.
Dupree says he was forced to face the hill and slowly down climb using crampons and ice axes to keep from being blown off the icy surface again. Dupree worked his way down toward his 7,200-foot base camp on Kahiltna Glacier yesterday. He hopes to be picked up by plane and flown back to Talkeetna before more bad weather moves in. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Matt Miller and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Ben Matheson in Nome, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.